Hi everyone. I am joined here today on Pedagogy Non Grata with Hannah, who is the is a speaker and a podcast host and an upcoming author as well as an online educator. And we're going to be talking about her new book, Reach All Readers. But before I go any further, Anna, would you tell the audience a little bit more about yourself?
Yeah, well, thank you. And thanks for having me here. It was a pleasure to have you on my podcast quite some time ago explaining the basics of research. So I'm glad to be here. I was a balanced literacy teacher, very much so, for about 8 years. And then I left the classroom to raise my kids. And a few years after that, I started a website, which I thought was going to be about parenting. So I called it The Measured Mom. And then it became a teaching website, but I kept the name. And I was still very much tied to balanced literacy and my website. I had many balanced literacy articles. I had a course about teaching reading based on balanced literacy. And then it was around 2019 that Emily Hanford's article, At a Loss for Words, helped me realize I needed to maybe look at things again. And that was kind of my structured literacy, the beginning of my structured literacy journey. And so now I do share resources based on the science of reading and continue to learn about it. I offer webinars and I've updated most of my website. It's a pretty big website. It's 11 years old, so that's taken a bit of time. And then this past year, I was able to write a book to help teachers like me who were unlearning balanced literacy and learning what the research really says about how reading works, along with practical ways to apply that.
Yeah, it's awesome. I will say, Anna, I really identify with you because I think we're sort of existing in a similar space. The space of supporting teachers with structured literacy, it's largely dominated by researchers, and I think that's a good thing. But like yourself, I am a teacher, and I also started off as more of a balanced literacy teacher, and I've over time switched towards more being quote unquote a science reading teacher, or whatever that means exactly. And it is a sort of a controversial term. So maybe I almost wanted to start off today with some definitions and where you understand things. I wrote an article a couple months ago about it was just a glossary of terms. And it was surprising to me how difficult it was to write terms and definitions that a large group of people could agree upon. So why don't we start off with what is the science of reading?
Yeah, so when I talked about that, I always say that the science of reading is a body of research related to how we teach reading and how reading works. Of course, the term also has taken on other meanings. Some people see it as a movement. Some people use it as a way to describe instruction, but at its heart, it's a body of research.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. Okay, so then let's talk about our next one. What is balanced literacy?
Yeah, so that's a hard one, because you can ask 20 people, of course, and they'll all say something different. So I'm going to describe it the way that I saw it as a balanced literacy teacher. To me, it was teaching with the goal of helping my students learn to love reading. And so that meant that I wasn't going to overdo phonics instruction. To me, that's kind of where the balance went in. It was a balance between, immersing them in literature and skills, but not overdoing the skills. And again, the heart of it was getting kids to love reading. So I thought that there were some things that would get in the way of that. So I was careful. I didn't really believe in explicit instruction. I wanted them to kind of come to their own conclusions about spellings and things like that through sort of implicit learning or, discovery learning, probably is a better way to say it. And then I was also opposed to decodable books because the ones that I'd had access to were not very interesting. And then I also really felt that my students would learn to read by reading. So they had long, long periods, even in my beginners, of working through their leveled, predictable books, because I thought that's what would help them learn to read, not explicit instruction on my part. And it's not that I didn't believe in phonics or I didn't know what phonemic awareness was, to be honest, but it's not that I didn't believe in teaching phonics. I knew that was important. I learned to read with phonics, but I didn't think we needed to overdo it. So for me, that was what balanced literacy was for me.
Yeah, it's funny you say that. I think that definition really matches well with some of the early definitions of balanced literacy. But truthfully, I kind of think a lot of what balanced literacy ended up being was sort of a rebranding of whole language. I don't know that whole language and balanced literacy in practice ended up being a different thing. And I just point that out because I think if we look at the definition of a whole language, a lot of people thought that meant you only taught whole words, and you didn't teach any phonics, but it really meant teaching less phonics and teaching phonics as needed. Which to me, is kind of very similar to what you're talking about there with what is balanced literacy. And I just want to say, by the way, not to talk too much during your interview. I also didn't know what phonemic awareness was until very late into my teaching career. I'd never heard of that term or of morphology.
Right.
So let's talk about then structured literacy, because I think most people, when they say they're for science of reading, what they're really saying is they want to promote structured literacy instruction in the classroom. So what do you view structured literacy as?
Right. So balanced literacy is sort of a haphazard approach to phonemic awareness and phonics. Like, we know they're out there and we're going to teach them as we need to and as they come up, but we don't want to overdo it. And we don't want that to drive our instruction. Like, the literature drives the instruction and then we insert the phonics where we think it fits. Whereas with structured literacy, we're starting with the code. We know that that is what kids need to get a strong foundation. So it's explicit, systematic. We're using a scope and sequence, sequential instruction. So we're not just hopping all over depending on the shared reading text. We're going in a particular order. Not that we can't talk about something out of sequence, but we're keeping track and we're going in order. And then another thing is the high frequency word teaching is different. So in a typical balanced literacy classroom, that's a lot of memorizing what we consider to be irregular words. Whereas in structural literacy, even those, what we might consider irregular words, are specifically taught. They're not just flashed on a flashcard. And then the practice is, to me, is the biggest difference for beginners. So my teaching was mostly in first and second grade. So I was really working to build reading from the ground up. And I thought, as a balanced literacy teacher, they should focus on meaning first. So we read these predictable books so they could read them, in quotes, fluently, get through them really quickly and understand it because they could read it so fast. Whereas with structural literacy, we understand that we're going to get to meaning, but we want to work on the code, which could mean very slow, laborious reading at first through those decodable books. And we're not worried by that because we know that that practice to automaticity is important. So the reading material is different. Another thing is that with balanced literacy, you're so focused on meaning, you don't get hung up on individual words that might be wrong. So if a child read house for home, we don't stress about that because they got the meaning. And that's what matters. Whereas with structural literacy, you would point to the word and, you know, you want their eyes to go back and figure out what that word actually is. And then another big difference, again, is that with balanced literacy, I thought kids learn to read by reading, need lots of reading practice. And of course they do need reading practice, but at the very beginning, the way they get better at reading is by being taught the code and then practicing with materials that feature that code. And then again, what people like to say, balanced literacy is the point of instruction is to teach kids to love reading, whereas structured literacy, the point is to teach them to read. And I know Margaret Goldberg has a really great podcast or article on the Right to Read website where she says we can't teach love, but we can teach reading. Something good to remember.
Yeah. Yeah, I completely agree with all of those things. I think that was the goal of balanced literacy for sure. It was this idea of being focused on meaning. It was almost like we wanted to teach comprehension before we taught reading.
Exactly.
And I don't know that that makes sense in any ways. I mean, if there was any one thing for me as a teacher when I was coming up through that balanced literacy system, it stuck out as a weird thing. It was that focus on comprehension. I always thought, even as when I would consider myself a balanced literacy teacher, I was like, wait a second, how are we focusing on meaning above accuracy? That doesn't make sense. Well, let's talk about that. It's like, what makes balanced literacy so awesome to some people that they can't give it up?
Yeah, well, okay, a couple things. First of all, I think a lot of us are taught to do balanced literacy, so we do hold on to what we were taught. So I would say my undergrad was, it was kind of a mix of all different things, kind of depending on your teacher, but there was definitely a whole language element there. This is the late 90s. And then balanced literacy really came into its heyday when I started grad school. So it was very much a focus of my graduate school education. And so I trusted my teachers. I mean, and they had, I don't fault them. I mean, I don't look back and think that they had any evil intentions. I mean, this is what they believe too. Especially in the early 2000s, when this was pretty widely accepted. It shouldn't have been, but it was very widely accepted. So I think learning it initially when we were first learning to be teachers. And then I think confusing, as you've talked about, professional books with the research itself. So like, I was really a big fan of Lucy Calkins' books and her professional books. So like The Art of Teaching Writing, The Art of Teaching Reading. I really loved Reggie Routman's books, Reading Essentials and Writing Essentials, and then the Founders and Pinnell materials. And because they told so many great stories, and it just really painted teaching as this beautiful picture, the way I'd always imagined it to be. So their books just inspired me. And every summer I would read them again and imagine how wonderful teaching would be the next year. And then real life would come and it wouldn't quite be the same, mainly because what I didn't realize was that I didn't really have the tools I needed to really explicitly teach these skills, but I didn't know that was what was missing. So there's that allure of it just seeming so magical, because that is really how Lucy Calkins writes. Like, it sounds magical. Then you take a little closer of a look and you realize that in her Art of Teaching reading book, because I counted, I think the book is like 600 pages, and she mentions phonics six times on six pages in a book about teaching reading to little kids. So a bit of a concern there. But it was the magic of it. And then, you know, so many people become teachers because they love reading and they love books. And yeah. So literature is at the heart of whole language and balanced literacy. And I think a lot of people are afraid of what happens if you switch to a structural literacy approach, that you're going to lose that. And that is a valid concern. I mean, teachers have to remember that it's not just about phonics. There's so much to it. But yeah, I think it's the love of literature, what we were taught. And then it just sounds so
wonderful,
amazing. And I'm also going to say it's easier in a way, right? Like, it doesn't really work for everybody, but when you're doing it, it's a lot less preparation to just pick a book, a text, and then going through a guided reading template versus looking at your data and figuring out exactly what kids need to learn next. That's a lot more complicated and requires a lot more skill on the part of a teacher. So I think those are the things that, for me, that made it appealing.
Yeah, that makes total sense to me. Speaking of preparation, you don't have to have the same level of skill, right?
Yeah.
You don't need to, like, there's a certain level of linguistic knowledge you need to have to teach a structured literacy lesson. And I know for sure, despite having researching and writing about this for a long time, I'm still learning tons. I don't know everything, not even close. So there's just so much to learn linguistically if you're going to teach phonemic awareness and phonics and morphology. And then you can get into some of these more complicated things like syllable types, which we might talk about a little bit more in a minute. So what convinced you? You know, you mentioned Emily Hanford's podcast, but what about her podcast was compelling to you and made you think, oh, I got to change my mind. I've got something wrong.
Yeah. So I have to say that it was not the podcast that changed my mind, but not initially. The podcast got my attention because I actually had a blog post about 3Qing with the diagram and everything, and that this is how reading works. I gave presentations to teachers about 3Qing and why you needed to do running records to determine the level of your students and how they were using the cues. So I fully believed in it. And when she wrote this article, basically saying that she's called it a flawed theory of how reading works and how it was getting kids set up wrong and teaching guessing, just really got my attention, because that was the heart of what I did. Like, that really was, if someone asked me, how do you teach reading? That would be what I would have started with.
Wow.
So I just felt like the rug had been pulled out from under me, but I also, at first, I really didn't think she could be right. Like, there's no way. Like, there's just no way. Nobody had even, I'd never, of course, I wasn't reading any of the stuff where people were criticizing 3Qing. I was reading all the things by Calkins and everyone else. So to hear that, I thought, first of all, she's got to be wrong. So I reached out to some people. And then I found out that actually a lot of people were rethinking this, and there was a lot of work I had to do. And so that's what happened. I reached out to people to ask, how can I refute this? Because I know it's wrong. And finding out that actually she had some really good points. And then I started studying it. It was really tough. I always tell people when I first started learning about the science of reading, I joined the big Facebook group. I could only be in it for 10 minutes a day because I literally felt sick. Like, I just, there were so many things that I had been sure were true that were just being pulled apart. And that was really tough for me. Over time, I began to enjoy going there. And now I really enjoy going there to get links to webinars and things like that, especially. But the things that really got to me, that really finally kind of turned my mind around, were understanding orthographic mapping. That was one. Like this idea that the way that kids remember words is not by reading them, I'm not by seeing them over and over in a predictable book, you know, even though you can learn some words that way, you reach a capacity. It was by actually mapping the sounds to the letters with the meaning. And that when I thought about that, it made me realize that the leveled predictable books my students, my beginners were reading, were really doing a disservice. They was actually wasting their time because since they were only using the first letter or part of the word, they weren't mapping those words because they weren't reading all the way through. And so I was bypassing orthographic mapping. And then reading about Stanislaw Stehan's work and how he said, if you're teaching kids to use context or pictures to guess at words, you're actually training an inadequate circuit in the right hemisphere. So that was a big thing for me. And then when I, so all, we have six kids and I've taught them all to read before they go to school, just because I think I should get to be the one to do that. And when my youngest, this was when my youngest was hadn't learned to read yet. So I decided, okay, I'm going to try this. And I had him read a leveled book and a decodable book on the first day. We started with the decodable book. And then I had him read the leveled book because I didn't want to give those up. I wasn't ready to. And right away, when I had him start to read it, and I said, well, he couldn't, he was trying to sound it out like he'd done the other book. And I said, well, you can't sound this one out. Let's use the picture and the first letter. And then all of a sudden it was like, duh, like this huge light bulb over my head. Why am I doing this? This is so inefficient. I'm giving him mixed messages. And that was a big turning point for me too. So those are the two big things, orthographic mapping and how the brain learns to read.
That's really interesting. I got a sort of tangent here of questions because, you know, I was taught the three cueing method in school. And it wasn't something that ever gravitated to me, if I'm being truthful. But at the same time, I have noticed now there's people claiming that three cueing isn't a thing. Like,
isn't it a thing?
You almost feel gaslit.
Yes.
You're like, I remember seeing the three cueing poster in all of these schools.
Oh, really?
Like, and yet you hear people online who work for Balance Literacy companies being like, three cueing is not a thing. No one's ever done
they
this.
They do. They do and, that. They do.
And I'm just sitting there wondering, so you taught people to do three cueing. I'm just curious, where did you learn about three cueing? Where did that come from?
Yeah, it's hard to remember exactly, but I'm pretty sure it was graduate school. Yeah, like I didn't just come upon it myself. Like they taught it to us. And then it was reinforced in the books I read. And I, you know, I couldn't, unfortunately, I'm really sad about this. I got rid of a lot of those books. I wish I'd kept them because then I could go back and find things. But, you know, I know I'm almost 100% sure in Riju Rautman's Reading Essentials, she talks about not overdoing phonics. And, you know, I had all the books, Phonics in the Proper Perspective, and, you know, all these books about, we could teach phonics, just, you know, don't go crazy. Interestingly, Fountain Spinell had a blog series, an audio blog series about their response to all the criticisms. This was, I don't know, a couple years ago, and they've taken that down now. It's not there, but I actually did a 10-part podcast series responding to each of their audio. And I have little blips of their audio in there to respond to. And they do very clearly, they might not use the words three cueing, but it's very clear that that's what they teach.
That's what I've noticed too, is that we changed it to multiple sources of meaning or multiple cueing methods. We can't say three cueing. We have to change it because that has been brutally attacked. Yeah. Well, I was just curious about that. Okay. Yeah. So I'm just curious now. You talk about in your book this idea that there is some divisive topics within the science of reading community that you feel are not necessarily positive for that community in trying to promote a research-based perspective. And I'm curious to what those things are. Where do you, it almost reminds me of, there's this term in fitness called majoring in the minors.
Yeah,
it's just this idea of you're overly focusing on the minutia of details and not worrying about the things that actually matter. So what do you think these things are?
So I don't address all these in the book, but I do talk about some of them. And there's just some things that I think people get really worked up about. And what bothers me is when people say, well, research says, when there actually isn't a research consensus around a particular topic. And I think it's completely fine to have different opinions about how to do something, but I don't like it when people say this is the best way. Without saying this is my opinion, because that's where these big fights come in, and they're confusing for people who are trying to figure this stuff out. So one of the, you know, the classic example is, do we teach letter sounds first or letter names first? There's really, like there was a funny Steve Dykstra. I was at a presentation that he gave in Wisconsin a couple years ago, and he was talking about that. He said, don't get a bunch of teachers in a room who disagree about whether you should teach letters or sounds first, because they'll pull out knives. And it does get really, really heated. And so I think, I mean, basically what Shane Piasta says is that we should teach them together. That's what research seems to say, without, you know, a strong feeling on either side. I just don't think we have to get caught up in that. There's also, I think, a really big one right now that I see being brought up in Facebook groups is, what's the right balance between whole group and small group? I think what we just, yeah, that's a big can of worms. So I think there's some people who really think that the science of reading means no small groups,
yeah,
or no centers. Yeah. And the people really do say that though. And I think that concerns me, because some people are getting this idea that we can meet everybody's needs in a whole group lesson without any differentiation. And there's different opinions about how to do that. My preference has been to start with the small groups, and then, so you're not wasting time, in my opinion, but plenty of people teach the whole group phonics lesson, differentiate within that. And then after, I think either way can work, but what we have to be doing is meeting everyone's needs. And that's not just the kids who are scoring below benchmark. That's the kids who are advanced too. I think they get lost in this right now. Nancy Young talks a lot about that, about how it's not okay to say that the kids who are, you know, doing super well are going to be just okay. They actually need instruction for them too. And so, you know, remembering that everybody deserves to have at least a year of growth and that your instruction should allow for that. That's a big one. And then I want to, here's another funny one, is people are always arguing about how to map certain words with phoneme graphing mapping. And I think people can just realize this is not a perfect science. And that one thing I learned from Lynn Stone is like that not every letter deserves to be mapped. You know, it's in there because it's an orthographic marker, not because it actually represents a spelling. So just being a little more open-minded about that and being okay about not mapping a word, like maybe teaching it a different way. If it, like the word one is just such a hard one, right? So people like to teach that it goes with the word only and once, with that meaning of one, versus trying to figure out how to map it. We don't have to map everything. And then there's also where people get really up in arms about which words are irregular and which words are not. Sort of, someone teaches the word have, for example, as a heart word, and they'll put the heart over the E, someone will say, well, that's not really a heart word because English words don't end with V. And then like they'll get in a fight about this. I'm like, you know, this is just, we don't have to get into the weeds. Let's just let every teacher decide how they want to teach those irregular words. And also know that heart words are great because they draw attention to individual sound spellings, but there's no research on heart words that I know of either. So there's just,
I think there's kind two of the wild studies. West. I think there is two. I haven't evaluated.
Oh, good. Thank you.
I have not looked at them, but I think there are two studies. But two studies is not enough to know if it works. So it might as well be no studies, truthfully.
Yeah, so there's no consensus. We're just getting started. And the same thing with sound walls. I mean, they're starting to be, I know of at least one study that's in the works for sound walls, just of someone working on it. But there gets to be a lot of debate about how exactly to do a sound wall. How exactly should I do my lesson? Well, that's just opinion. I mean, do it in a way that helps your students learn those sound spellings and don't worry about what someone else says about what exactly should be on your sound wall. There's a lot of debate about whether we should have mouth pictures or, you know, I just think that's, personally, I think that's just extraneous. And then I think another thing is sometimes in Facebook groups, if someone asks, where's the research, people will send a link to a blog post. And you've talked about this. And blog posts are great. Like if someone says, you know, what do you think about this? And someone says, well, here's Tim Shanahan's post. Here's what he thinks. That's great. I mean, I'm all for reading people's blog posts and getting their opinions, but that's not the research. And I think people get confused by that. I had someone, another one, of course, is the six syllable type debate and syllable division. That's a big one. Mm-hmm. At this point, I think that it's useful to teach kids to read words with different syllable types. I'm not really a fan of the complicated Orton Gillingham style of syllable division, which I did learn when I was Orton Gillingham certified. But to me, it's a lot. and I'm not sure that it's worth its time that it takes. And it's just very complicated for kids who might be struggling. But, you know, when you go back to syllable types, the thing is, I mean, programs that use syllable types work and programs that don't use syllable types work. And I had I had a post about syllable types, and I basically said, you know, I think they're useful, but not everybody agrees on that. And research doesn't really say. And she was like, every program that is science of reading based teaches syllable types. I said, well, actually, that's not true. And she said, oh, yes, it is. And she said, letters recommend syllable types, and they're the things you should respect the most. And I was like, well, letters is a great program, or, you know, teacher development program, but that's, you know, I think you should reach out to them and find out for sure where the research is coming from. That may just be how they prefer to do it. And I said, can you send me a link to an article? She said, the classic thing, right? Well, I'm sure if you go to Google Scholar, it'll come right up. Like she wouldn't find it.
I feel like
me.
I've had this exact conversation on like 20 different pedagogies, like 100 times.
Yeah. Yeah. It always ends up with them telling you to find the research, right? And I don't expect teachers to have research at their fingertips. I don't. Like if someone asks me, where's the research that maybe synthetic phonics is superior to analytic phonics, I'll go look up the reference that I have. I don't have it memorized, but that's what teachers should do. They should say, well, let me get back to you versus, you know, sticking their feet in the sand.
I had this exact interaction earlier this week. Someone was asking about what phonics program I should use in grade 3. And I said, you probably shouldn't use a phonics program in grade three. And then I got told I was wrong because of the science of reading. And I said, well, what could you elaborate? Like, what study are you referring to? And they said, haven't you listened to any podcasts? And I was like, what about research? And then they sent me Scarborough's reading rope as evidence that we should be teaching phonics in grade three. And I was like, oh, well, I don't know, but that proves what you think it's proving.
Yeah.
But it is a funny thing how I think podcasts and books have been, and blogs have been equated to research. And, you know, I'm someone who writes about this all the time, but I definitely don't want someone like grabbing one of my blog posts and being like, this is the definitive science on this topic. I'd much rather you reference the citations in the blog
exactly,
post
exactly.
For the specific information.
Exactly. Because, you know, it's a lot. I mean, I wouldn't certainly expect teachers to plow through really difficult research articles. I don't like to do that. But what you do is you look for meta-analyses, and people like yourself are really good meta-analysis. People like you are really good at distilling that for teachers. Find somebody who speaks in plain English, and then if you have questions, ask them. And if it's somebody like you who really cares about the science, you'll educate people as to where they can go. But yeah, a little bit of knowledge can be a dangerous thing. I wouldn't want to take it away from teachers, and I've certainly been there myself. But I think we just all need to be looking at the science of reading with humility and understanding that there's so much to learn and that there's a lot of people we can learn from, but we don't have to make one person be our ultimate authority on any of it.
All right. I couldn't agree more. I think some of that is a little bit of a hangover from balanced literacy too.
And yes,
we're really focused on this celebrity model of, well, we have to find the new leader who's going to tell us what science is. And I think that's sort of antithetical to science, this idea that you're just going to find someone who's going to tell you all the answers. But I completely agree. And I really want to say, I really agree with you strongly that we're getting way too focused on these issues of minutia, like syllable types or non-syllable type speech to print or print to speech. Most of these questions, I think, really boil down to personal preference. And I think that's okay. And I think where people get worried is that sometimes they had someone who was a big influencer tell them, no, this is the answer. And they put their trust and their faith in that person as being their new source of truth. But I don't know that that's necessarily a good way of looking for answers. Sometimes I think we should be considering a plurality of perspectives rather than just one person too.
Yeah. And it's funny, when I was first learning about the science of reading, that was really troubling to me when I went into the Facebook group and people were disagreeing about stuff like syllable types, for example, because I thought, wait a second, I thought we all had this figured out now, but now we can't agree on stuff. And then of course, over time, I realized that that's not how it works, and that there's a research consensus in some areas and not others. And I, you know, when you were on my podcast, we talked about that, about how that's takes time. And there's always still people who might disagree, even though after we think the consensus has been established. But one thing that Steve Dykstra said once that stuck with me was that there's not enough research to dictate everything you do in your day. You can't fill every minute with something that you know for sure is backed by research. You just take the things you do know, and then you choose things that you think are going to work, and you test them out. And if they work, you do them. And if they don't, you do something else, or you scaffold, or you add more explicit instruction. But it's not about finding every single thing that research backs. We just have to be careful not to, another one I could have mentioned before was the multi-sensory piece, right? Like people have very strong opinions about, you know, when I did my Orton-Gillingham training, we had like a plastic sewing thing. I don't sew, but some plastic grid that underneath, and they would write their quote red words, like the irregular words. And that was supposed to help them remember those words, that multi-sensory piece. And, you know, research has not found that specific, this bothers teachers when I say this, but it doesn't have strong support for multisensory instruction. And I don't know how many times I've read this on different blogs, that multisensory instruction is important because it activates different circuits in the brain. And I don't know where
circuits?
That comes. Yeah, I don't really know what that means, but or different pathways, but I read that everywhere, but I never see a citation for it.
Yeah. You know what? Honestly, I don't want to sound like I'm disparaging on neuroscience, because neuroscience is important and it's definitely contributed to this field. But for whatever reason, within the blogosphere area, it seems like we get a ton of pseudoscience that's focused on neuroscience. And it's like, if you throw the brain in there or circuits in there, everyone's like, oh, this is really smart. It must be true. And you get a lot of really crazy things. So whenever I see the reference being, well, because of the brain science, I'm always like super extra skeptical.
Brain-based, right? Those are the big words to be afraid of.
Yeah.
Because what does that mean? All learning is brain-based. Of course it is.
Yeah. Okay. Well, when is your book coming out? When will people get to read it?
Yeah, so it's coming out July 23rd, and it is available for pre-order. If people want to just go to reachallreaders.com, it'll redirect to a place where they can read a little bit about it. And then if people do choose to pre-order, they can go back to that page and enter their order confirmation number, and then they'll get free access to my Science of Reading mini course. And so the first module is basically an overview of the science of reading and how research works. And the second module answers about 15 commonly asked questions about applying the science of reading. And the last module is basically 5 steps to get you started. So I just talk about specific things teachers can, changes they can make to their instruction, that includes printable resources to get them started.
Well, that's awesome. Well, I really hope the listeners go out and buy your book, because I know that they're going to get something that's both grounded in actual teaching experience, and also something that is really well thought out in terms of the research. So I strongly hope that everyone listening checks out Anna's book.
Thanks so much, Nate.
That's it for now, folks, and until next time.